This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, the 5th of October, 2006. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. House Speaker Dennis Hastert says he's sorry about the congressional page scandal, but will not step down. A key Democratic senator says he fully supports a phased troop withdrawal from Iraq. And we'll hear from a city in California considering a measure to raise the minimum wage to $9.25 an hour. We'll bring you those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. U.S.-led forces handed over control of eastern Afghanistan today to NATO. The handover now makes NATO responsible for security throughout all of the country. NATO forces first took control of the southern provinces in late July. NATO has an estimated 31,000 troops in Afghanistan. In Indian-administered Kashmir, 10 people are dead after an overnight gun battle between suspected guerrillas and police in Srinagar. Shanawas Khan has more.
The gunfight began Wednesday when suspected suicide attackers threw grenades at a Central Reserve Police Force camp in the heart of Srinagar. Resisted by the security personnel, the gunmen entered a nearby hotel, thereby beginning a 26-hour gunfight. The encounter ended in the afternoon today with two attackers dead along with seven police and paramilitary personnel. One civilian was also killed in the gunfight. Local news agencies said guerrilla outfit Al Mansurain took responsibility for the attack and said three gunmen had launched the attack, of which one returned to their base. Police in Srinagar denied that anyone had escaped. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Shahnawaz Khan.
More than 14,000 prisoners on hunger strike in jails throughout the Buenos Aires province in Argentina have ended their protest for fair sentencing regulations. FSRN's Marie Trigona has more from Buenos Aires.
The hunger strike, which lasted 14 days, was called off after judicial authorities agreed to rule that time spent in jail should count as part of any eventual sentence. Many accused criminals in Argentina spend years in prison awaiting trial. Protesters were also demanding prisoners be released upon completion of their sentence. The protest leaders report that hundreds are still in jail after completing their sentences due to corruption and slow courts. The hunger strike protest for speedier sentencing began in a prison close to the capital and quickly spread throughout jails in Greater Buenos Aires. Human rights groups supported the prisoners' demand for an overhaul in sentencing and improved conditions inside jails. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigona in Buenos Aires.
As militants step up their attacks in the Niger Delta, the Nigerian military has retaliated with a series of attacks on villages in the region. Sema Lakoya reports from Lagos.
With gunboats and helicopters, the Nigerian army has attacked villages it believes local militants have been using as bases. Villagers have been fleeing their homes to escape the assault. In the last 4 days, militants fighting for control of the oil resources in the Niger Delta have launched at least 5 attacks on the business interests of key Western oil companies. The attacks have left 23 soldiers and one local oil worker dead. 30 foreign oil workers have been kidnapped within the last 4 days. Some of them have been released. The Nigerian government has summoned military chiefs for crisis talks in light of the escalating violence. Britain has in the meantime asked its citizens not to make non-essential travels to the Niger Delta. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
Construction work has begun on a controversial natural gas pipeline in Ireland, despite widespread local opposition. Maeve Conran reports from Dublin.
Protests have been taking place this week at Shell gas stations across Ireland and at Shell Ireland headquarters in Dublin to show solidarity with the local protesters in Rossport Mayo on the west coast of Ireland. Shell received permission 2 years ago to build a natural gas processing terminal on land in Rossport, despite protests from locals over safety concerns. 5 local men were jailed for 3 months last summer for obstructing the construction of the pipeline. Shell Ireland recently announced that it will alter the route of the gas pipeline to move it away from houses in the Rossport area. But residents say this does little to deal with the larger safety concerns. Earlier this week, a large police presence escorted construction workers onto the worksite and removed more than 100 protesters. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Maeve Conran in Dublin.
Protesters in Oaxaca, Mexico have handed over the broadcast facilities of the Radio Organization of Oaxaca. The building houses the studios of three radio stations. It had been occupied by anti-government protesters since August 21st. Protesters continue to hold a separate AM station in Oaxaca City. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Two new developments in the Mark Foley scandal are haunting Republicans in Congress. The House Ethics Committee met and formed a separate subcommittee to look into who knew what and when about former Congressman Mark Foley's contact with teen congressional pages. The Ethics Committee will also investigate if there are more members who have committed acts similar to Foley's. Howard Berman is a ranking member of the House Ethics Committee.
Our jurisdiction for this investigative subcommittee was laid out by the chairman. It's dealing with the conduct as a result of the actions. We do not have jurisdiction over former Congressman Foley because he's no longer a member of the House. We are dealing with a fundamental institutional issue that we think was placed squarely in the hands of the Ethics Committee, both by the House's action last Friday and by any logical interpretation of the rules.
The House overwhelmingly passed a resolution calling for an ethics investigation last Friday. The committee has called for 4 dozen subpoena documents and testimony. The committee of 2 Republicans and 2 Democrats plan to speak with lawmakers, staff, and officers. At a press conference today, members were unwilling to say if House Speaker Dennis Hastert is the subject of investigations. Meanwhile, the man who has become the center of the storm as to if and how much he knew about the Mark Foley scandal, House Speaker Dennis Hastert, held a highly anticipated news conference where rumors of his resignation swirled. He announced instead that he's going to run for House Speaker again after the November elections. He also reconfirmed his ignorance to any inappropriate communications by Mark Foley and announced that Foley will be investigated by the Justice Department, the FBI, and the state of Florida. To aid the investigation, he set up a hotline for people with information.
We have a toll-free number where people can confidently call, and we've reached out to experts around the country to put a system in place to make sure this never happens again. The tip number is 1-866-384-0481. We will do everything possible to make the program safe for the kids while they're in our care in Washington, D.C.
Several Republicans have called for Hastert's resignation, including Christopher Shays from Connecticut, but head of the Ethics Committee investigation, Doc Hastings from West Virginia, says he supports Hastert. A key Democratic senator says he stands firm behind a phased troop withdrawal from Iraq. He spoke to reporters today on Capitol Hill after a 5-day tour in Iraq. FSRN's Yame Shea has the story.
Michigan Senator Carl Levin is the highest-ranking Democrat on the Armed Services Committee. He was in Iraq when the Iraqi Prime Minister al-Maliki announced a 5-point plan to end sectarian violence in the country. Iraqi militias from different sectarian groups signed the agreement. However, since the announcement on Monday, 13 U.S. soldiers have been killed in Baghdad, and U.S. military commander in Iraq says attacks against U.S. troops are at all-time high. Levin calls the agreement a ray of hope that is tenuous at best, and he reminds that previous agreement of similar nature failed to curb violence.
Another reason to be very skeptical and to be very cautious about this agreement is because there are no provisions in the agreement to disarm, to disestablish the militias.
Prime Minister al-Maliki promises to work out a plan to disband militias in the next month. Levin warns if militia groups remain armed, Iraq is doomed to an all-out civil war. The senator says U.S. generals in Iraq signal that Americans should not expect any troop reduction this year. U.S. Joint Force Commander General Lance Smith says this morning the continuous war in Afghanistan and Iraq has overstretched the troops.
The Army is on a one-to-one dwell ratio right now, where they're back in the States for a year, and we'll go back over a year after being home for a year. And we are trying to drive to a one-to-two kind of dwell, so they're back in the States for 2 years.
According to the senator, Iraqi leaders want an open-ended commitment from the U.S. And he believes that is precisely why the U.S. should set up a timeline to bring American soldiers home.
We got to force them to be more realistic, to look into the abyss. And to give them enough time, enough lead time, and I suggested about 3-4 months ago that it be the end of the year, so that they would have 5 or 6 months that they could work out the political compromises which have to be made on power sharing, on resource sharing.
Levin says key Democrats have signed a letter to President Bush outlining a timetable to withdraw troops 6 months from now.
If Democrats took control of either house, that or both, that house or houses of Congress would hopefully adopt that kind of a urging to the president. It's not binding on the president, but it would be a recommendation which I believe would carry some real weight.
Levin traveled to Iraq with Chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Virginia Republican John Warner. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice arrived in Iraq today for a surprise visit. For Free Speech Radio News, Ye Meixie in Washington, D.C.
A new report in this month's issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry found that large numbers of soldiers returning from Iraq suffer post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. Those who suffered severe physical injuries often developed PTSD 7 months after sustaining their injuries. Researchers found that injured soldiers' likelihood of suffering from depression and PTSD went up drastically over time following their homecoming. Sergeant Thomas Grieger is a professor of psychiatry at the Uniformed Services University at Bethesda, Maryland, and co-authored the report. He spoke with FSRN's Aaron Glantz.
We can only speculate at this point the reasons why the rates rise with time. It could be a gradual recognition of the impact of the injuries. It could be prolonged physical problems that complicate recovery from the PTSD symptoms. It could be a return to an environment where they're expected to perform as either in their profession or, you know, to be an active father and spouse. There are a great number of issues. It may be that their pain medication control or their use of psychiatric medications has not been as carefully monitored in an outpatient setting as it would have been during the hospital setting.
After I read your study, I sent it to a friend of mine who was a lieutenant in the Navy, and he was part of an aircraft carrier battle group that was with the initial invasion of Iraq, and he ran bombing missions over Iraq and was also a spokesman for the Navy. And now he's having a really difficult time. And, you know, he's been in and out of the VA and the hospital since then. And he said to me, you don't need to have the kind of traumatic injury that these folks are talking about in order to be suffering from PTSD, that the two are not necessarily related. Is that correct?
Certainly. Just exposures can cause PTSD, and then you have symptoms of intrusion where you may have nightmares, recollections, flashbacks, to the degree that you're physiologically and psychologically affected by those intrusive thoughts. You have symptoms of avoidance in which you spend energy and time trying to not think about the thoughts, not talk about them, not expose yourself to circumstances which are in any way similar to the event that triggered the problem. And then finally, individuals have problems with irritability, poor sleep, and being vigilant of their surroundings in an overly defensive way, being on guard constantly.
If you're a family member of somebody coming home from Iraq, what should you watch for to see if your relative is suffering from this ailment? Because it can be very hidden for long periods of time.
I'd be concerned if they weren't sleeping well. I'd be concerned if they had given up activities that they previously had engaged in. I'd be concerned if they really demonstrated discomfort at reminders of their war experience or their other traumatic experiences. Those are the things I think are most evident to family members. Sometimes people call out in their sleep and wake up from nightmares. To the extent that that happens over a prolonged period of time, I'd be concerned.
Yeah, I was a journalist and I reported from Iraq on three different occasions over a great deal of time since the invasion. And when I came back in 2004, after spending a lot of time in Fallujah, I had a really hard time because there was a news helicopter port right near our house. But then over time, I've become more accustomed to hearing civilian aircraft. I don't freak out anymore. What happens to somebody who comes back? I mean, anyone who's just coming out of a war zone is going to have this kind of reaction to a lot of sounds, this hyper alertness you're talking about. What's the difference between that and PTSD?
I think it becomes a disorder when it's causing dysfunction to the extent that individuals change their activity patterns significantly, or it changes their relationships with their family or with their employers, coworkers, friends. Those are really the elements that lead to an impairment. I've seen several soldiers and sailors who have come back, had serious symptoms, chose not to report them, and continue to have severe symptoms throughout yet another deployment. Oftentimes, individuals will try to manage it on their own, and regrettably, in many cases, it comes down to the use of alcohol to help calm down. I would add that to the list of concerns for family members, is if their returning veteran is drinking more frequently or in larger quantities for an extended period of time after return, that would certainly be a red flag that they need to see somebody.
FSRN's Aaron Glantz speaking with Sergeant Thomas Grieger. President Bush returned his focus back to domestic issues today. At Woodbridge Charter School in Washington, D.C., he touted his No Child Left Behind education initiative as a success. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell has more.
President Bush spent his morning talking about No Child Left Behind. He met with employees at the Department of Education, then headed to an inner-city charter school in northeast Washington, D.C. Woodbridge Elementary is one charter school that has been called a success in raising the education level of its students. No Child Left Behind, or NCLB, was enacted in 2002 to much criticism. Critics deplore standardized tests and a curriculum that focuses on tests. Thus far, the results are mixed, and President Bush is pleased.
I'm proud to report the achievement gap between white kids and minority students is closing. For the good of the United States. How do I know? Because we measure.
But for the 2007 school year, there will be
no new, additional funding for Title I, which is the main component of NCLB for disadvantaged minority kids, that to help them close the achievement gap. So there was going to be no additional funds.
Ed Keeley is the director of the Committee for Education Funding. He says for 2007, the president requested a $2 billion cut in funding for the main components of No Child Left Behind, and Congress has followed suit. Funding for next year is expected to stay at 2006 levels, which is less than 2005 appropriations. Again, Ed Keeley.
There's less resources for schools, school districts, and students. More students are not going to be getting the services they need. They certainly aren't going to be fully served under NCLB with these funding levels.
Not including next year's funding projections, No Child Left Behind is already underfunded by $40 billion. But President Bush isn't looking back.
And so one of the top priorities next year for me will be the reauthorization and the strengthening of the No Child Left Behind Act.
Those improvements did not include money for the program, but instead high school testing and incentives for teachers. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
A recent panel discussion held at the University of New Mexico focused on the ways in which the United States can maintain its nuclear weapons stockpile in a safe, secure, reliable, and affordable way. But as FSRN's Leslie Clark reports, two nuclear weapons labs representatives were challenged by audience members.
Joe Martz is Los Alamos National Laboratory's project director for the Reliable Replacement Warhead, or RRW. Martz joined panelists from Sandia National Laboratory and the National Nuclear Security Administration discussing the new nuclear weapon being designed in the National Nuclear Weapons Complex. Martz says the legacy nuclear weapons from World War II are safe today, but the national labs are looking toward their sustainability for the future.
And so we're simply asking the question, given a chance to change, what would the change look like? But look, this is a feasibility study, and it's up to the policymakers, to NNSA, to the DOD, to decide whether or not there's enough compelling arguments to go down an RRW path compared to the strategy that we're on today, which is supporting the legacy stockpile.
Martz is confident the replacement warheads won't increase the number of nuclear weapons in the country. They'll only replace existing bombs. Nuclear weapons are required, according to the panelists, to deter other countries from attacking the United States. But audience member and Mideast specialist Catherine Hughes-Fertek challenged the panelists about maintaining any kind of nuclear weapons stockpile.
Why don't we look outside the box and look at not improving them, look at really disarming as we've agreed to do. So we should, I think, be looking at a better deterrence, down the line leadership for the world, and a better use of our money, healthcare, dealing with AIDS, dealing with a lot of things around the world, that if we worked on those things, I can tell you the Arab nations, the Muslim nations would love us. For a lot less money, they'd be our allies and working with us toward peace, which is much more effective deterrence than this kind of weapons.
The United States signed the International Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, promising to reduce and eventually eliminate nuclear weapons from the stockpile. But some on the panel call elimination of nuclear weapons wishful thinking. Not so, according to nuclear nonproliferation activist Greg Mello.
It's not wishful thinking when states demand the implementation of binding treaties, which become U.S. domestic law under the Constitution at Article 6, Clause 2. That's not wishful thinking, it's the law.
Assistant Professor Elizabeth Stanley agrees. Stanley is on Sandia National Lab's National Security Advisory Board. She says the International Court of Justice ruled on the law a decade ago.
First, nukes are immoral. That was the court's ruling. The second was that nuclear weapon states really had to have their feet held to the fire. And it makes sense that the non-nuclear powers are wanting us to uphold the law, because we spend so much time as a country saying rule of law is so important and pointing our fingers at other countries that aren't living up to the rule of law. It's complete hypocrisy.
Susan Stoner of the National Nuclear Security Administration says it's important to remember no decision has been made whether the replacement warheads will go into the nation's nuclear weapons stockpile.
If it is deemed feasible, then we will, through our budget process, we will ask Congress to appropriate funds to move forward with development of RRW. Development doesn't mean it's gone into the stockpile even yet. Only the president can authorize whether it would actually go into the stockpile or not, and we are many years from that.
In the meantime, Sandia National Lab will continue to hold discussions about the reliable replacement warhead. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leslie Clark in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Congress has repeatedly failed to bump up the minimum wage. Since 1997, it's remained at $5.15 per hour. Since then, 19 states and at least 3 cities have raised base pay rates higher than the federal minimum, while scores more have enacted living wage laws for government contractors. This November, voters in Arizona, Colorado, Missouri, Montana, Nevada, and Ohio will decide whether or not to raise their own hourly base pay. And in Santa Cruz, California, the year's hottest election issue is Measure G, a citywide proposal to raise the minimum wage to $9.25 per hour. FSRN's Vinnie Lombardo examines the measure's potential impacts on the local economy.
Last year, labor and community activists formed the Working Alliance for a Just Economy, aka WAGE, and gathered enough signatures to place Measure G on the November ballot. If passed, Measure G would force all businesses and nonprofits in the city of Santa Cruz to pay at least $9.25 an hour starting January 1st with annual built-in cost of living increases.
Workers tell us
This is a great idea.
Nora Hochman is the Wage Campaign's volunteer coordinator who quit a job to dedicate herself to passing the wage increase.
Santa Cruz is a very unique place in terms of the cost of living, and questions of affordability are very challenging here. For example, in this very small town, one-bedroom apartments cost about $1,200 a month. You know, it seemed logical to us that $9.25 an hour could simply give workers a better shot at survival.
But a coterie of local business owners have predicted disastrous impacts on the Santa Cruz economy if Measure G passes.
I think I'd rather have the cash in my pocket and I'll deal with the consequences.
Larry Pearson chairs the board of Goodwill Industries in Santa Cruz, which reported revenues of $12.7 million last year from donated items. Goodwill employs 76 workers in Santa Cruz who make below $9.25 an hour. Pearson also owns Pacific Cookie Company, a $2.5 million annual business that employs 25 workers at its production shop. Goodwill and Pacific Cookie Company have both threatened to relocate most of their business to unincorporated areas of Santa Cruz if pay rates go up.
We'll have to raise prices or reduce shift hours, try not to reduce shifts. We're not going to affect benefits, but we will do some things in order to accommodate ourselves. And we'll move outside the city. All of our production facility will have to move outside the city.
But a city-commissioned study to examine the impacts of a base pay hike sees a less dramatic outcome. The 40-page report by Bay Area Economics concludes city revenue would see no dramatic change and suggests the extra income will boost worker morale. Economist Simon Alejandrino led the study.
Santa Cruz businesses would be able to adjust to the new minimum wage for the most part.
At $9.50 an hour, Santa Fe, New Mexico has the highest pay in the U.S. In San Francisco, the minimum wage is $8.82 per hour. Alejandrino looked at studies done from both cities.
The reports found that there was slightly negative or neutral impacts following a minimum wage hike.
Historically, with minimum wage measures, businesses are always threatened.
With monthly rent, bills, and other expenses exceeding $1,500, Arsene Vartanian is a typical Santa Cruz resident. The 26-year-old grad student often works three jobs to make ends meet. In between a hectic class schedule, Vartanian currently works at a car rental outlet and as a food server.
If we look back to 1965, if the minimum wage was indexed to that year, it would be about $10 right now.
Economist Alejandrino says some families currently getting health benefits might lose them due to the higher wage. But for the most part, he says low-income workers will end up better off.
You certainly pay them a higher wage and they have more money after taxes to pay for housing and to pay for, you know, all the other things you need to survive in the area.
Governor Schwarzenegger signed a law mid-September to give California's low-wage workers a raise from $6.75 an hour to $7.50 beginning January 1st. That figure jumps to $8 an hour 1 year later and will be the highest state minimum wage in the U.S. The proposed Santa Cruz wage hike represents a 15% increase over California's new minimum wage. Again, wage coordinator Nora Hochman.
It's not going to make anybody rich. And in fact, for a family of four working all year round, earning $19,240 a year at $9.25 an hour, that family of four will still qualify for public assistance because they'll still be under the federal poverty guidelines.
Wage campaigners say $9.25 an hour is still not enough, but the raise would make a huge difference to the roughly 4,000 Santa Cruz workers who need it most. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Vinny Lombardo reporting in Santa Cruz.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News from KPFK in Los Angeles. I'm Ada Bogado.